Mystery in Cedar Falls, Iowa, as another financial firm goes belly up.
And let's look at some actual numbers. Are Americans' taxes high or are they low? Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. It is Wednesday, July 11th. And coming up, in addition to talking about the collapse of this financial firm, Peregrine Financial, we are also going to talk about a company that's trying to emerge from bankruptcy and may have to get a merger to do that. That would be American Airlines parent company, AMR.
Also going to hear about a very controversial internet censorship bill in Russia. And Jeremy and I are going to ask why we, that is to say all of us, always seem to choose the first thing that we see. It's coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The parent company of American Airlines is trying to emerge from bankruptcy, and there's news today that AMR is reaching out to other airlines in search of a merger. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan of Airline Weekly. That's a publication that covers the industry. He joins us now from Fort Lauderdale. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, for a long time, Seth, American Airlines had said, you know, we're going to go through the bankruptcy process and then maybe we'll think about a merger. Why this change?
Well, American's management knows that a merger at this point is very likely to happen with or without them. And they would rather be in charge of the process. U.S. Airways has been very public about thinking that a combination of U.S. Airways and American would be very good for both airlines. Well, American's management sees that a lot of its key stakeholders might agree with that, and so they'd rather be the ones picking partners and ultimately in charge of the combined airline.
Well, we've heard that the unions are on board with a merger, potentially with U.S. Airways. So who does not want to do that on the American Airlines side?
Well, the unions are three votes of what's basically a nine-vote creditors committee, it's called. You can almost think of it like a Supreme Court of who runs the airline while it's in bankruptcy. These are different stakeholders. In addition to the unions, you have some bondholders, people who lent the airline a lot of money. You also have a few key suppliers, companies like Boeing, for example. Certainly, there's enough movement toward a merger that management is concerned that one would happen, and they're now doing what they can to get those stakeholders back on American management side.
And quickly, Seth, when do you expect this will all be wrapped up?
Not likely before the end of this year. This would most likely at this point be a 2013 transaction, whether the airline comes out of bankruptcy on its own or gets together. But these things can change.
Seth Kaplan of Airline Weekly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's election season, and so we're in for all kinds of rhetoric on taxes. We're not paying enough to cover growing social programs like Medicare and Social Security, or we're paying too much, stifling people's incentive to work. Into this mix comes a new report from the Congressional Budget Office saying the tax rates paid by most Americans are at near record lows. The data come from 2009, takes a while to compile all these numbers, and of course it's more complicated than that. So we've got Bill Frenzel. Until 1991, he was a Republican congressman from Minnesota. Now he's a scholar at the Brookings Institution. Good to have you.
Glad to be with you.
Well, Congressman, it seems like we're hearing all the time this conventional wisdom that Americans are being taxed like never before. Is that apparently not true?
Well, it isn't true, at least in 2008 and 2009, because gross tax collections as a percentage of GDP declined in 2009 to about the lowest point since World War II at 17.4%. The reason for the decline is because income was declining.
So it's a factor of income. That's a big part of it. Of course, the rates people are paying and the amount of deductions they can take are also very important. Can you put those in historical context for me?
Yes, the deductions are somewhat similar, except for lower income taxpayers. But for the higher income people, those deducts and tax gains are about the same as they have been.
And let's look at that, the 1%, let's call them. How high are their taxes compared with the trend over time?
Well, the top 1% earns about 13% of all the income, and they pay 23% of all the taxes. The bottom half of taxpayers pay almost nothing. So we have a very progressive income tax system, But of course, that's leavened by the fact that the Social Security tax system is quite regressive.
Bill Frenzel is a former Republican congressman from Minnesota. Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Elsewhere in Washington today, the House Agriculture Committee is set to take up the Farm Bill, which sounds like legislation that's all about farming. But in fact, about three quarters of it goes to fund food stamps and other nutrition programs. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
There's been an explosive expansion of the food stamp program. To understand why, you have to go back to the 90s and President Clinton's welfare reform, which trimmed welfare rolls. In 2002, to help those cut off, Congress and President Bush made it easier to qualify for food stamps. Since then, the food stamp program has more than doubled. Sheila Zedluski is a public policy analyst at the Urban Institute.
Enrollment was approximately 18 million people, and now it's about 46 million people.
That's about one in seven Americans. Many of them lost their jobs during the Great Recession. But why is the food stamp program in the Farm Bill anyway? Like most things in Washington, it all boils down to politics. Chad Hart is an economist at Iowa State. He says farm state legislators needed a way to connect with more urban members of Congress so the city slickers would support farm subsidies.
And the easiest way was through nutrition, talking about food programs, bringing the food that's produced in the countryside into the city.
And bringing Washington's political games into the barnyard. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Well, Jeff, CNBC has come out with its annual ranking of the best states for business.
All right.
And number one this year is Texas.
Really?
That's thanks in part to the state's infrastructure and low cost of living. Also, it ranked very highly in innovation and technology, probably in part because of places like Austin, which are really booming right now thanks to a big high-tech industry. Last year's top state was Virginia. That state lost its ranking on the list in part because of its clogged highways, which, of course, make it difficult for people to get to work quickly. California and Massachusetts tied as the best states for a business to access capital. And even though it was only ranked 19th overall, New Hampshire made it to number one on the list in terms of quality of life.
I can see that, sure.
Live free or die. And you can see where your state stands at marketplace.org.
So I took a look at Ohio, which is right in the middle of the pack at 25 overall, but it's above average in access to capital. And this is where I make some kind of grand segue to this item from Toledo, Ohio. Well, everybody probably shares some version of this vision of picking through an attic and stumbling on some kind of treasure, right? I'm always hoping I'm going to find some great musical instrument. I never do. But I go through so many attics and it never happens. Whatever. So anyway, these cousins in Toledo are picking through their deceased grandfather's attic and they find this sooty box with a baseball card collection in it that's in great shape. And some of these cards are more than 100 years old. There's a Ty Cobb in there. There's a Cy Young in there. And this all adds up to $500,000 at least for this collection.
I haven't looked back to my old baseball cards, but I'm just doubting that there's anything in there that's worth I think we had a Wade Boggs in there.
Saved them. I lived in Milwaukee when I was a little kid, so I've got lots of Milwaukee Brewers cards from the 80s.
Yep.
Who cares?
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
We live in a world full of options, 50 different kinds of cereal, hundreds of iPhone apps, but a new study has found that we consistently choose the options that are thrown at us first.
Dana Carney did the study. She's at the University of California, Berkeley's Haas School of Business, and she's here to talk with us for today's Midday Extra. Hi, Dana.
Good morning.
Tell us how you determined that people have this particular gut reaction, going for the first thing we see.
Well, we did a number of experiments, all of which asked people to make decisions either really quickly or after they've thought about it for a little while. And it looks like no matter what options you give people, when they're forced to think quickly, they choose the first thing to which they were introduced. And that goes for people or consumer items or even criminals that they were told could be let out on parole.
So if I said to you, would you like one egg for breakfast, two eggs, or three eggs, you're most likely to say one egg.
if I'm in a rush.
Okay. Is this a kind of a coping mechanism because we have so many options, or what? Why do you think we do it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's not clear. On one hand, you could imagine that this is something that we've evolved rather recently to kind of help us navigate efficiently through a world of tons of options. On the other hand, there's a lot of evidence, even in non-human animals, that firsts have a kind of privileged status. So this could be a much more kind of basic animalistic mechanism that helps us just detect what's safe and what's not. It's not always rational or good to gravitate towards first thing. So maybe that was originally the mechanism that was developed, you know, long ago in our evolutionary history, but this leads to errors. We are privileging firsts in ways that might not be in our best interest.
Well, can you see the implications of this in any product that's popular or something that we like, and you can say that's because it's the first option?
There is a privilege in the first thing that comes out. So, for example, the iPod is a good example of something that came out first. It was sort of like the biggest deal was made out of that particular smartphone. It's not clear that our research would speak to that issue, but there is definitely power in firsts across the board. And so having a first product or, you know, the first idea, the first impression, all of that stuff is going to stick more in the mind of the perceiver. And it's hard to update after you have an impression. It's very hard to update and kind of override that, even in the face of tons of good information that suggests that you should update.
Marketers surely have had an instinct about this for a long time, right? This kind of first mover advantage. Is it something that as consumers we should be wary of in ourselves?
Absolutely. I think that, we should all be wary that the way in which information is presented to us could be biasing us towards certain products or towards certain decisions. Now, here's, one good thing about the research that we did is that humans are less irrational when they take a couple of seconds. So, if you would just wait a couple of seconds, that some of the natural errors that we make aren't made.
Well, have you updated ever since you've done this study? Have you corrected your own personal behavior?
I don't know. So I definitely try to be mindful as I navigate through the world and try to override all the biases and irrational ways in which, my mind works. But it's hard to do that, right? So, one of the reasons why lots of social psychologists have interesting questions to ask is that it's very hard for individuals, despite their mindfulness, despite their desire, it's very hard to override your kind of natural architecture.
Dana Carney of the University of California, Berkeley's Haas School of Business, thank you so much.
Yes, my pleasure.
So now to Cedar Falls, Iowa. That's the home of a brokerage firm called Peregrine Financial, which has collapsed amid accusations from federal regulators that Peregrine defrauded customers and hid its losses.
More than $200 million of its customers' money has allegedly gone missing, and the firm has been engulfed in scandal. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
The Peregrine Financial Group said it had more than $200 million worth of its customers' money held in an account. But regulators discovered it didn't have anything near that. The account only had $5 million.
In the context of the size of the company, of Peregrine Financial, it is an absolutely enormous shortfall.
Jason Carrion is with the Economist Intelligence Unit. He says there are parallels here to MF Global, which also had a big shortfall. In that case, over $1.5 billion. Carrion worries a trend may be emerging.
It would not surprise me if more cases like this did come out.
He says this also points to a bigger problem, that federal regulators may not be well enough equipped to find shortfalls like these.
There is a lot of new regulation in the U.S. financial system, as a result of things like the Dodd-Frank Act, but that usually runs ahead of enforcement, which is a lot more expensive.
The Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which has said it needs a bigger budget to police the futures industry, has asked a court to freeze Peregrine's assets. I'm David Gura from Marketplace.
And for more on the Peregrine story, let's bring in Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Josh, what's your takeaway from this strange story out of Cedar Falls?
It's unbelievable. I mean, this is 9 months after MF Global had $1.6 billion missing. So this is $220 million that was supposed to be in a bank account, according to falsified records from the founder of this firm. Turns out there's really only $5 million in that account. People I know in the futures industry are just beside themselves right now.
Well, is this a failure of regulation, or what do you think?
undoubtedly. This is a situation where, I mean, it's really gotten to the point where the regulators are captured. They don't have the budgets. It's not 100% their fault. They're relying on Congress for funding. And it's just an area that has been kind of light touch, especially when compared to the work that the SEC does. And I think that they have to get a lot tougher.
Is there something to the fact that this, in addition to MF Global and even Bernie Madoff, happened when the markets aren't doing so well? Is that coincidence or what?
You know, I think fraud is something that happens in perpetuity, but it only gets noticed when the tide goes out, as Warren Buffett said, and you see who's swimming naked. People are not making money. Bonds have no yields. Stocks aren't going up. Futures and commodities have crashed. People are just unhappy, and they're looking around, and they're asking the questions that they don't ask during times of prosperity. So it feels like there's more. The truth is we're just noticing it now.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So if you load up the Russian version of Wikipedia today, I'm sure everybody was planning on doing that, you're going to find a big pink bar across the top of it. And the site shut itself down completely yesterday in protest of an internet bill that looks likely to pass the Russian parliament. Human rights groups are also up in arms about this thing. To see what they're so worried about, I've got reporter Peter Van Dyke with me from Moscow. Good to talk with you.
Good morning, Jeff.
As it's written, what would this bill actually do?
Well, it would allow a government to put a number of websites containing material that is harmful or threatening to children on a blacklist that would require the websites to remove them. And if they don't remove them, then the internet provider hosting the website would have to remove the whole website. And if that doesn't happen, then the internet service provider could be shut down.
And why does the government of Russia, which backs this thing, say that it needs the bill?
Well, it's a protection against material that is harmful for children. Now, the problem is the very wide possible application and the very non-specific language in the law that has people really concerned.
As you look at the language of the law, where is it that skeptics see this potential for abuse?
Well, it's specifically where it talks about what can be put on the blacklist without any sort of court oversight. Now, there is a further measure within it that says other illegal material can be included on the blacklist by going through a court. And in Russia, illegal material is quite loosely defined, and it includes things that call people to have extremist acts. So there is a concern there that with just the say-so of a judge, things like that could then be included into this blacklist, and that would allow its reach to go far beyond what it is normally intended to do, which is protect children.
Peter Van Dyke reporting for us from Moscow. Good to talk with you. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff.
To many people, Yahoo has become synonymous with chaos. CEOs coming and going, management lurching from one turnaround strategy to the next. Well, tomorrow is the annual shareholder meeting, and interim CEO Ross Levinson looks likely to get the permanent title. But will anything change? Here's Marketplace's Queena Kim.
It's been a crazy couple of months. Make that years at Yahoo. And BGC financial analyst Colin Gillis is ready for the drama to stop.
It all has a chance to come to an end at this shareholder meeting on Thursday. Put in Ross as the permanent CEO.
Ross is Ross Levinson, Yahoo's acting CEO. He's focusing Yahoo on its main money makers, content and advertising.
The point is incremental change, not wild change.
Gillis says that Yahoo gets about 700 million clicks a month, and it made about $1 billion last year, mostly from selling ads. But Clay Moran, an analyst at Benchmark Capital, says by playing it safe, Yahoo lost ground to Google and Facebook.
They felt like they had a big brand and a lot of cash, and they didn't want to risk that.
Moran says Yahoo needs to make a bold move. His suggestion? Buy Hulu, the online video site, or find another way to get in big on video. But Moran's not sure that Levinson is ready to take that risk.
And so it will be more of the same, which will be received largely with the yawn.
Not much drama in that. In San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
In North Carolina, lawmakers have passed a law about planning for rising seas. Basically, it forbids coastal communities from making any plans that factor in the latest climate change science. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, here's Eve Troe.
Real estate agent Tom Ronica has an ocean view from his home on Cape Hatteras. He often gives newcomers a book called The Battle for North Carolina's Coast.
And one of the common responses I've gotten is, I'm afraid to read it. I'm not sure I want to know what it has to say.
Because most everyone has seen the shoreline shift after a hurricane or nor'easter. And what's at stake is where people can or should build.
Setbacks from the ocean, depending upon what the erosion rate is.
Part of that erosion is due to rising seas. And to be clear, everyone agrees the sea is rising, but it's difficult to say how much.
Almost nobody will actually see sea level rise.
Spencer Rogers is a construction and erosion expert with the public agency Sea Grant. He's on a state panel that said the sea is rising faster than we thought. How much faster?
The accelerated rate over 30 years is 3 nickels thick.
The legislature isn't worried about 3 nickels. It is worried about the 90-year prediction. That puts the sea a meter higher than today. Regulations based on that prediction could hurt development. The state's frozen any plans that factor in rising seas until a new study gets done. But people along the coast will find the latest science on their own, says MIT economist Michael Greenstone.
The North Carolina legislature can no more hide this information than they can vote to ban rainy days.
And the big-time money doesn't look that far ahead anyway, says Janice Oshinkowski. She studies risk for global real estate firm Jones Lang LaSalle.
Ocean levels are not expected to rise significantly in the next few decades, and investors typically look at a 5 to 10 year investment horizon.
Sea level rise might impact how people build or protect their property, but everyone already knows coastal real estate is risky, says Nags Head realtor Greg Cremai.
I think that people should just be warned that in 50 years their house might be gone, and then let them decide if they want to do it or not.
And most of them, he says, will still do it. Buy something on the beach and enjoy it as long as they can. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
So the good news is, Jeff, we're living longer these days. The bad news is, well, what? The older we are, the more expensive we tend to be. Hmm. Which brings us to today's Money Matters segment. We're going to focus on the financial and non-financial decisions that families face when caring for an elderly relative. And joining us to discuss is Marketplace's Adrian Hill. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Adrian, so many people face this problem. What are you supposed to do when you have an elderly relative who is having trouble taking care of himself or herself, but they don't want to make that move into an assisted living facility?
Basically, start talking about it and keep talking about it. I asked psychologist Dr. Barry Jacobs about this, and this is what he told me.
This is not a conversation that takes place once. This is a conversation that takes place multiple times, sometimes over months and years. Unfortunately, with some families, the move doesn't occur until it absolutely has to. In other words, some medical event has to have happened.
The idea is to discuss really early on what kind of care and life and lifestyle your relative might want and how best to get there. Now, you've also got to start talking or at least thinking about money at this point because these things are expensive.
How expensive are we talking?
Well, it depends on the kind of care you need and where you live. I asked an elder care attorney here in Southern California named John Lansing how much it'd be ideal to have set aside just to make sure all those costs were covered.
$500,000. If you figure that the cost of care for a nursing home is at least $100,000 a year, then $500,000 is a conservative estimate.
A conservative estimate? Well, how are people supposed to afford $500,000? Obviously, that's not the kind of money everybody's got lying around.
It's not, and a lot of people don't, which is why these numbers of unpaid elder care providers are as high as they are. Now, people who have the savings to do this or family members with income to pay usually wind up paying for long-term care on their own. There are also long-term care insurance policies out there, and there are government programs that can help. Medicaid can step in if you exhaust your savings. Medicare can also assist if you need medical help, but it doesn't cover things like assisted living facilities.
Marketplace's Adrian Hill, who will be hosting our consumer finance show, Marketplace Money, this weekend. Thanks a lot, Adrian.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And now, as they say, to something completely different. Jeff, let's go to Minneapolis, where there's a different kind of film festival happening next month.
Okay.
A film festival of internet cat videos, like like this one, The Angry Talking Cat. And according to the LA Times, the film festival will last up to an hour. Hopefully not just with that angry talking cat.
Well, that's not such a horrible segue. I mean, elderly people love cats. So I think it plays nicely. Okay. Now, here's something that's completely unrelated. The other day on the podcast, we mentioned an endangered frog named for Prince Charles. And there are very few of them. And so that was a very savvy thing to do to kind of get attention for the frog. Well, today we have another example. The honor goes to Bob Marley, though, Jeremy, I think if Bob Marley were still here, I'm not sure how much of an honor he would think this is. Hmm. It's the Nothia marleyi, the scientific name, and it's described, I love this, as a parasitic crustacean blood feeder.
Ah, lovely.
Some nasty little critter that lives in coral reefs and jumps out to suck the blood of the beautiful passing fish, apparently. In its defense, the discoverer of Nothia marleyi calls it a truly natural wonder and as uniquely Caribbean as Marley.
You know, that reminds me of, I'm not sure if you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm, but there's an episode where Larry David has a sandwich named after him at a local deli, and he's really upset because it's a whitefish sandwich, which he thinks is disgusting. So,
well, be careful what you wish for.
Be careful what you wish for. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.